The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and in your life. Yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Jay Heinrichs. Jay is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Thank You for Arguing, What Aristotle, Lincoln, and Homer Simpson Can Teach Us About the Art of Persuasion. The book has been published in 12 languages in 3 editions and is one of the top 10 books assigned at Harvard. Jay has been named Professor of the Practice of Rhetoric and Oratory at Middlebury College. A content and editorial consultant specializing in persuasive engagement, Jay serves clients ranging from NASA to Southwest Airlines to the Wharton School of Business. Jay, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
So every once in a while, I'll get a recommendation from a friend that I should book a particular guest for the podcast whose work I'm not familiar with, and that was the case with you. And since the cornerstone of this podcast is the intersection of comedy and improvisation on contemporary thinking and behavior, it was a delight to realize as I was reading Thank You for Arguing that you seem to know quite a lot about both comedy and improvisation.
Oh, boy, now I'm in trouble, aren't I? I have to be, like, persuasion boy and funny.
Look, there's more quotes from Homer Simpson than Aristotle in this book.
Yeah, that's because it's really hard to teach logic through Aristotle. But, you know, the humor in The Simpsons is all based on logical fallacies. So Homer beats Aristotle.
And you talk about Yes And, which was the name of my book and is part of the name of this podcast. And I did not know this going in. It was based on other guests I had. But what I want to get to, for starters, is the sort of central theme of the book or a statement you make at the beginning of the book. And a wise person once said to me, if it can't be used for evil, it's not a superpower. And you write... Right? You write, quote, "Rhetoric can be, often is, a destructive force. That alone is reason enough to learn it, if only to inoculate ourselves against its manipulation. But rhetoric also offers the most healing power I know. I honestly believe it can save our civilization." So sitting here right now with all the events that have unfolded in the last, you know, I could say 24 hours, 48 hours, 6 months, do you still believe that?
More than ever.
Yeah.
I mean, for a couple of reasons. First of all, rhetoric created civilization as we know it because it's a skill that brings people together to do things in common. And it also is a skill that builds trust. You know, some people use that as a dark art to make them trusted. But on the other hand, if we lose all trust in each other, which seems to be going on now, then we're kind of screwed as a civilization, right?
Yeah. And what's great, because you've updated this book, right? And it's nice because you do include, like, Obama and Trump and showing their skill at rhetoric, though it's quite different.
Yeah, each is completely different. I mean— Obama is more of a traditional kind of orator, you know, beautifully written speeches, beautifully delivered. Trump actually uses this device that's 3,000 years old that was invented by the Greeks, who had a deep understanding of how the body and mind work together. And they theorized, and this has been proven true, actually, in neuroscience, that a human thought can be sustained for about as long as a human breath.
Yeah.
So a long orator's kind of human breath. So I actually researched this and went online, and I looked up all the speeches when they got to the applause lines, you know, like the climax of speeches. And then I looked up movie speeches from, like, every sports movie ever made where the coach speaks in the locker room to Braveheart and all the rest. And I found consistently in both political speeches and in Hollywood, when the music starts to well up at a speech, that they were all, those climaxes were all about 12 seconds long, which is about 40 words, and it's one sustained human breath. Now, Trump uses these 12-second bursts one after the other. So it's like he doesn't have a climax to his speech. He goes from one to the other. Mm-hmm. And some rhetoricians call this the comedic style, you know, set up, punchline. But I see it as more like doing the ancient Greeks only on speed.
Yeah. It's interesting. My wife is a comedy professor, and so we've been like sort of somewhat hounded in the last year for our opinion about how Trump uses comedy. Is he funny? Is he not funny? And I'm like, he totally uses comedy, but he uses it like an insult comic does in terms of, you know, making an other. But he's also speaking to his tribe as well. And Obama had like beautiful comic timing, but it's much like what you were talking about in his oration. He handled it differently. He didn't use it to segment a population in the same way. And I happen to think, as a comedy professional, that Trump is funny. I don't know that the things he's doing are all that funny, but I mean, like, technically speaking, there's comedy being used there.
I totally agree. Yeah. I think he is genuinely funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I also agree with you that he uses that humor to divide people.
Yeah,
absolutely. And, you know, it's funny because that is kind of like the ultimate dog whistle is humor, right?
Totally.
I mean, some people laugh and some don't.
Yep. Yep. Oh, I mean, I've been dealing with this for years, right, at Second City. So because we do cutting edge satire that people don't always understand, or they're take, you know, people love to be offended on behalf of others. And it's when you wield that well, and I think this is why, you know, our late night TV is just like while Colbert is killing Fallon, is because he is just using a scalpel comedically. And that's who Stephen is. I mean, that's what he does. Whereas Jimmy is just sort of a happy kind of comic.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's funny. Steve Martin years ago told this joke. He talked about, you know, early in his career having to speak in front of all these trade meetings, you know, convention types of gigs. And he said he could always knock them dead if he could tell a joke that was only understood by that one profession or trade.
Mm-hmm.
So he would tell this joke that had a punchline, you know, just to plumbers,
yes,
where the punchline was something like, I said socket, not sprocket. Well, I actually one time gave a talk to a group of foresters.
Uh-huh.
And the punchline was something like, what happens when you get below a number 7 roundwood? I'm not going to explain this joke to you, by the way.
Okay.
And the punchline was, actually, I don't remember the punchline, but it knocked them dead.
Yeah, they loved it. They loved it. I mean, look, we get booked to do this stuff all the time.
7 roundwood, and they were already laughing, you know.
Yeah. I won't linger on the comedy thing too much longer, but there was one thing I thought of. My wife has this saying that comedy doesn't change the world, but comedy shows you that the world has changed. And that's, you know, based on her research and our, you know, anecdotal experience over the last 3 decades working at Second City. And I don't know if I think you probably are familiar with the research that shows that many times political comedy can sometimes limit actual action on the part of the individuals because they feel that they've already done their bit by listening to the comedy.
Yeah, first of all, your wife sounds like a genius.
She is.
Her title, like the most amazing title. you know, she's using this great figure of speech. It's my favorite one, called the chiasmus, where, you know, comedy doesn't change the world. Comedy shows that the world is changing. That is, you know, John F. Kennedy gave one of the most famous chiasmi, which is, you know, ask not what the country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
Yeah.
That's such an amazing device. In any case, yeah, I have looked at this research that shows what rhetoricians have known for thousands of years, which is that if you limit your tools of rhetoric to emotion, you're not going to change anything. It's a great way to get people in the mood for persuasion, but then you have to use other devices, such as talking about the future in a logical way that will actually bring people together to do things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So let's go back a step two, because I think it's important for a thing that you do, which is talk about the difference between fighting and arguing. So, I mean, this is one of the most relevant aspects of the book, is the distortion that exists when we can't unmoor ourselves from fighting rather than arguing. Can you talk to us about the difference between those two?
Yeah, in a fight, you are trying to dominate the other person. And you may do that by trying to win on points or threatening someone or intimidating them or just talking them to death. That's a fight. You know, it's two opponents, one wants to win. And if the other wins by totally crushing the other one, then that's a successful fight for one side. In an argument, you try to win over the other person. And ideally, this doesn't happen too often, but when it does, it's amazing. You want the other person to feel as if they won, too. So can I tell you a story from the book?
Yep.
It's a true story. I was years ago, when my son was 15, I found myself alone in the bathroom with no toothpaste. The tube had been squeezed dry. And being the father of a teenage son, I knew who the likely culprit was. So I shouted through the closed door, "George, you used up all the toothpaste." And I hear this sarcastic voice on the other side saying, "That's not the point, is it, Dad? The point is, how are we going to keep this from happening again?" Now, the thing is, he had grown up hearing me talk about this amazing rhetoric stuff, including, you know, this device to get you out of trouble, which is to switch to the future so you can solve problems together for all time rather than being punished. I, on the other hand, was so excited that he'd actually been listening all that time that I decided just to let him win. So I said, "All right, George, you win. Now will you please get me some toothpaste?" He says, "Sure, Dad." And he goes down to our freezing basement and gets me a tube. So he, to this day, thinks he won the argument, and that's fine with me. I, on the other hand, got a teenager to run me an errand without complaining.
Right.
So that is the ideal argument.
Yeah. Talking about your children turning on you, on your stuff, you know, both Ann and I have worked at Second City, as I said, for 30 years, and I wrote a book called Yes And. So if a no exits my mouth anywhere near them, I am completely like, "Oh, nice from the Yes And guy." I got an honorary doctorate. And so anytime I screw something up, my son calls me doctor. So these are good things. I find that and your book is filled with these stories. I should mention this, that the wonderful thing about this book is Jay sort of interchanges these very lofty and important discussions from history and thought with his family crap. And really drives it home. So one of the things I wanted to actually talk about, because you mentioned it, is this idea of controlling the tense. And that if you say that the one way, if you're losing an argument and you want to shift it, is just change the tense.
Yeah, so I had to get all rhetorical on you.
Go for it.
Rhetorical theory. This does come from Aristotle, who's the man when it comes to rhetoric. He literally wrote the book on it. Aristotle said that there are three kinds of rhetoric. One is called forensic, which takes place in the past. That's the language of crime and punishment, where you do forensics on toothpaste.
Yep.
When you talk about the past, basically you are blaming someone and trying to figure out how to punish them. The present tense is reserved for what he called demonstrative rhetoric, which is also called sermonic rhetoric, because its sermons are delivered this way. And it's about right and wrong, good and bad, who's good and who's bad. I call it tribal rhetoric as well, because it's separates the devils from the angels, good sons from bad sons. And so if I had lectured my son and said, "George, a good son wouldn't use up all the toothpaste," he'd be a lot more considerate. And you can imagine he'd probably get pretty defensive or just walk away. So Aristotle's favorite rhetoric is what he called deliberative rhetoric. He also called it political rhetoric. It's where you make decisions. You deliberate about what you're going to do to change the future. And that is the tense that you want to be in if you actually want to make choices together, or at least get somebody to make your choice.
And that is in itself a bit of a yes and, because what we often tell beginning students is we have you say yes and so that you stay in the conversation, not so that you're agreeing to everything that's being said.
Yeah, now we're in a realm of rhetoric, if you're not just being comedic, called concession.
Okay.
And concession can be used in a really kind of snarky way, where you use a person's words against them.
Right.
Or, you know, in the case of if you saved up all of Donald Trump's tweets, just use anything he tweeted a year ago from.
Right.
and to show how he's just completely changed everything you said. That's a kind of concession that's a little dark. But, you know, the yes and is a form of concession in that it takes what the person says and actually adds to it, gradually steering the conversation towards what you want.
Yeah. And so we have a program at the University of Chicago at the Booth School of Business. It's the Center for Decision Research, and we're studying behavioral science through the lens of improvisation. And one of the areas where we've sort of applied this yes and idea is in the area of staying inside a difficult conversation, which, as you know, on a college campus right now, this could not be more relevant, and it could not be more relevant in the world. And our thought is that too often we get ourselves into these rhetorical loops that eliminate levels of communication that make these walls go up that we're never going to get over. And the only way we're going to move forward is if we take the time to truly understand the position of the person across from us. Again, doesn't mean we have to agree or believe in it, but in the simple act of understanding, our theory is that this conversation can keep going.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant. I would add, I'm doing a yes and on you.
Please.
I would add that one of the things that you want to do at the beginning of any disagreement is to decide what you want out of this exchange. Mm-hmm. You know, what's your goal? And so often the goal you go after is just instinctively to counter what the other person says, you know, tell truth to power or whatever. Yeah. When really the most useful goal may be to try to build a relationship. Mm-hmm. So I did a consultancy with a group of pediatricians in California who are trying to figure out how to do better talking young parents into having their children vaccinated. These were people who had, you know, gone on the internet a little too much, gotten all the conspiracy theories and everything about vaccination. And so one of the things that we taught and what these pediatricians have been doing is just throwing logic at them and showing why they were wrong. Mm-hmm. And so for the most resistant parents, I said, you know, really, you're not going to talk them into it the first visit, but maybe the third. Can we work on that? And for those people who aren't sure, but just a little resistant, then maybe in the first one you can. But the first thing you work on is the relationship itself. And you know, as you know, if you use the yes and technique, you're being agreeable. You're making it so that the person actually wants to be with you.
Yeah.
And it's putting them into a frame of mind that actually makes them more persuadable.
So let's talk about that, because your section on decorum, for obvious reasons, really hit me. But what I enjoyed most about it, it didn't stop at like, hey, you know, you should be nice to people. For example, you say, quote, decorum follows the audience's rules. And that, I think, is a twist that people don't necessarily consider.
Yeah. And it's often people have criticized me for writing that because they say, boy, you know, so you're telling me to be a hypocrite. And what I'm saying is I'm telling you what it takes to be persuasive. Mm-hmm. And what that takes is not telling everybody that they're bad. So if you happen to be in a room where everyone is a tattoo, don't lecture them on their tattoos. On the other hand, if you're only the only one without one, don't tell them how lame they are.
Right.
You know, in some places, using a fork is a really bad idea. In other places, it's a necessity. You need to watch what you're doing. I actually, right after college, I applied to the Foreign Service, and I passed the written exam, and then I was taken to the oral exam. And it consisted of one question. Apparently, this at the time, and this was many, many years ago, I'm told they don't do this anymore. They asked just this one question, which was, you're alone in a room waiting in an embassy in a foreign country. One other person enters the room, sits under the sign that says no smoking, and lights up. Mm-hmm. What do you do? And I said something like, oh, I'd say, which is true, hey, I'm allergic to smoke. Would you mind just holding off for a little bit? Thinking that was a nice diplomatic answer. Yeah. And I got dinged. Okay. they didn't hire me. And later, I ended up, one of these guys, these interrogators, was on my swim team in Washington, D.C. And I said, hey, you don't remember me, but what would have been the right answer? And he said, ask him for a smoke. Huh. Ask for a cigarette.
So you're establishing rapport that then maybe you can get him to put it out.
Maybe what I should have been thinking of is how can I use this guy for my next diplomatic mission or something. That's extreme decorum. Yeah. I'm not saying for it.
I get it. You also in the section say persuasion requires sympathy. And I'm very curious about your thoughts around sympathy and empathy and the sort of, like, I read a lot of battles between, you know, people like coming out as being anti-empathetic now. And I'm curious where you land in that world.
Yeah. You know, empathy has problems. I'm not saying that, you know, if you're an empath, that makes you a horrible person and you're going to destroy civilization. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, the problem with empathy is literally empathy means you are feeling what the other person is feeling. Mm-hmm. The problem is if you're doing that, you're not going to be very useful to the other person. There has to be a part of you that's willing to go towards solution. That's not just getting completely emotional in the room. If you think of yourself, imagine you're a surgeon. You're not going to start crying because this poor person is hurting so much, you know, and, oh, no, look at the blood. You're going to, you know, reserve some of your emotion and operate on the person so you can fix them. You know, the same thing happens in any good rhetorical exchange where you're trying to make choices that will fix things. So now sympathy, on the other hand, is an awareness of the other person's emotions and an ability to change the person's emotions, to make them feel better, to make them more persuadable, to make them happier in such a way that then you can work toward the solution. So sympathy is a little bit more of like a professional emotion. Mm-hmm. And being an empath is more like being a complete emotional partner.
Yeah, I guess, you know, we get stuck in these terms because of the way they've been used in the past and you know, sort of what their root is. I mean, I always think about that sort of if I'm thinking about, like, the board that I'm in front of right now with all these sort of knobs that you can turn up to make you a little louder, a little softer, I feel like that's the spectrum with sympathy and empathy that you need to be negotiating when you are in a high-stakes situation or a negotiation, or certainly in a medical situation, because we've done a lot of work there, where you really doctors themselves need to understand that their patients are probably fear-based and may not be listening to them in the way that they need to be listened to, so they have to modulate, and vice versa. When you're in a lower status position, you're going to modulate your situation.
That's so true. There is something. I mean, it would be nice for me to have more of an empathetic dial that I can turn up every time. I have among my clients is a school of nursing, and, you know, it is amazing how much nurses do for people without administering drugs.
Yeah.
You know, and they do it in part because you really feel as if the other person is caring. Now, they do that professionally. So there's a lot of sympathy there. I mean, a lot of this gets turned on and off. My daughter, by the way, is a nurse.
Hmm.
With me, she's like the Dr. House of nursing.
Right.
She's like no sympathy at all, no, let alone empathy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, suck it up, Dad. On the other hand, I've seen her with patients, and she's amazing. She just turns on this apparent empathy, which is really sympathy, and it makes people better.
Yeah. So what's concurrent with this is this idea that we teach in improvisation of being others focused as a state of being. And you talk about knowing your audience. And this is especially important today because I think knowing your audience is not as simple as it once was, especially if really your only communication with them was from a live speech. But today we have all these mediums, right? So knowing your audience when you're calling or when you're texting or when you're emailing, or even the difference between, like, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, all the knowing your audience and then being able to modulate changes with each of those.
Yeah, and of course the problem is whenever anything is digital, you have to assume that the several people you're talking to or your, you know, couple hundred friends on Facebook are going to turn potentially into tens of millions of angry people.
Yep.
So same with emails too. I mean, these things can get away. I always tell people, you know, when you're doing anything that involves Wi-Fi, you are turning on a PA system, even when you think you're alone in a room. Mm-hmm. And that is so unintended audiences are often a huge problem. And now, on the other hand, if you are going after an audience on a particular medium, you do have to know that medium. And some media are more emotional than others. Some are more logical. And some are really good at portraying your character.
I just, Caitlin, who I work with at Second City, sent me a link to an article. It was an interview with the comedian Aziz Ansari in GQ. And apparently, he has gone off all social media. He is no longer on email. And he took the web browser off his phone. So, you know, you can text him. He reads the newspaper. And he was saying he feels – he's done this, I think, like 3 months. He feels so much better. He doesn't feel ill-informed. And he said he just got tired of watching wrestling.
You know, it's funny. This is a question for you. That, as a comedian,
yeah,
you find timing to be extremely important, right?
Yes.
How does timing work on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram?
So I can probably speak to Twitter the best because really I still haven't figured out Instagram in terms of comedy. And in Facebook, it's sort of like, I don't know, it's almost like a, you know, bulletin board. But in Twitter in particular, there's a few things. One is speed, because someone has probably already made that joke. And so if you are going to now jump on there, you don't want to be like the, you know, 10,000th person to make the same joke. You also have to sort of protect your this is the hard thing that you talked about, which is because you have unintended audience that don't understand you, you have to make it as like a joke that is context proof, that it doesn't matter. Because I don't know if you remember. Do you remember when Colbert got in trouble because someone tweeted out, this is back in the rapport days, his character saying something terrible?
Right.
And, you know, it's like, well, that was the character and there's no context, so you can't do it that way. And I found Patton Oswalt, who is a great Twitter comedian. He does lots of lovely threads. So there's, you know, basically 10 parts to it, sometimes like 25 parts to it. So it's so interesting, you know, that Twitter as a business is essentially failing. I think that's safe to say. However, it has contributed to dominance by media, dominance by our president, and dominance by our comedians. Those seem to be the three people who are using Twitter, and none of them are turning it into money for Twitter.
Isn't that interesting? So in rhetoric, the term for timing is kairos. And kairos doesn't mean exactly timing. It means opportunity. In fact, the Romans loved this idea so much, they actually had a god named Ocasio for occasion, who was had this beautiful young man and with flowing locks, you know, in front and completely bald behind, because the opportunity disappears pretty quickly. In other words, the occasion ages.
Yep.
And so it's interesting when you say that, because I say that kairos is a combination of timing and medium. And so it kind of makes sense that, you know, you look at politics and comedy, they both really depend on both those factors at once, don't they?
Yeah. So interesting. Okay, these podcasts go too quick. We're going to ask you for a yes and story. But before we do that, I want to get your thoughts. You talk a little bit about in the book, the buzzword of the moment, and there's many buzzwords, but one of them is in business world is authenticity. Everyone is striving for authenticity. We at Second City have a certain kind of viewpoint on that, which is that showing your blemishes is a good thing and wearing your failures, in part because we know comedically, you know, that's the best stuff. No one is laughing over your good story where everything went right. It's the opposite. So I'm wondering, in your knowledge base in this area, what does authenticity mean to you?
Well, the rhetoricians call that dubitatio, which is means doubt. So if you show that you're uncertain, that you're willing to open yourself up to uncertainty, that can be very tricky, but it can also win over an audience. In my case, I find that, you know, being authentic is like the opposite of lying. You know, with lying, you'd better be good, you know, especially in the digital age. You're going to get caught, and you better know how to get caught and get away with it. On the other hand, simply being direct with people while acknowledging them is the best thing. What I do, though, the one way that I am inauthentic that wins people over the most is whenever I go to a group of people I know I probably won't like. My wife is a fundraiser, so I have to
be
a number who should be paying higher taxes. I send love beams out of my eyes. I tell myself before I walk in the room, I love these people.
Right.
And you know what? I end up often liking them more than I really want to.
Yeah,
it works on both sides.
Yeah, there's science to that. The idea, you know, the mindset and going in and you know, with the telling yourself. I once had a Harvard professor tell me, because I said I got nervous before speeches, and she goes, no, you're not nervous, you're excited. Say that out loud. And I started doing it, and it really affected me in a very positive way.
Oh, that's interesting. I would say, of course you're nervous. You should be terrified. You can make a complete ass of yourself up there. And you know what? I bet you'd be better for it.
All right. I'll have to try that next time, though I don't want to. Okay. So we always end the podcast by asking our guest for a yes and story. So a time in their life where they might have normally said no, but they didn't. And they didn't just stop at yes. They said yes and. Do you have one of those for us?
I do, but it's not me. It's my wife. And she did it on me. So this, very recently, my wife and I went on a trip for our anniversary. We've been married 35 years. And so months ago, I did a ton of research, and I chose, after looking all around the world for the perfect place, I found this beautiful eco resort in Nicaragua. Mm. Peaceful, wildlife, amazing food, totally obsequious staff, judging by the pictures. And flowers all over the place, everything that she would love. It was perfect. So I presented this idea to her, and she did this total yes and thing on me. So she goes like, yes, and we can go on beautiful walks. And yeah, we can go on walks. Yes, and the food's really important, isn't it? And so are flowers. I love the idea of being pampered. We're never pampered. And I said, and animals. And she says, yes, and animals. You know how much I love sheep. And I'm like, well, there aren't going to be any sheep. And she interrupts me with more yes ands.
Uh-huh.
So I really love your idea of a place with gardens and amazing food and walking with sheep. So guess where we ended up? We ended up, this is 2 weeks ago, we were in the Cotswolds of rainy, cold England. It was beautiful. Food was amazing. My shoes will never recover from walking through miles of sheep pasture. No monkeys. Not a single monkey.
Yeah, though London, the food has improved greatly, I don't know that that has, you know, factored into the rest of England.
It was the food really was. I have to admit, it was amazing. We had a great time. Yeah, so it worked, and we were both happy. That's what counts.
There you go. Jay Heinrichs, thank you so much for coming on the show.
This is such a pleasure. By the way, I love your book.
Oh, thanks so much.
Working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, hoo, about to slip down. Working in a coal mine.
querida.